Hey, Clyde, come here and look at this. The sign that says, Fetid Fields, mortal danger, proceed at your own risk.
Oh, bud, I don't know if we're meant to be here.
Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 2 Scarecrow Tales. I hope you have enjoyed the little break we had and are ready for some more stories.
My husband's always in that damn basement of his. Maybe if I kill that stupid girl myself, I would see him more. My son told me he wanted to be a superhero. As he held the knife, I realized that I was the tragic backstory. I woke up in a dark, empty barn with my hands and feet tied together. As my eyes adjusted, I saw thousands of spiders on the ceiling, slowly descending toward me.
My life is stressful. I work too hard and my boss is permanently on my back. I'm already on a final written warning for performance. I seem to sink deeper into debt each month. My marriage is failing, and I just don't think I'm cut out to be a dad. I love my children, but I just can't seem to relate to them. Worst of all is the noise. I suffer from misophonia. It's not a recognized disease, they tell me, but I can assure you it's real. That intense discomfort and loathing you get when you hear something eating noisily, that's misophonia. It's the uncontrolled emotional reaction of anger some people get to certain noises. Misophonia combined with tinnitus make my life hell. I have a permanent buzzing in my ear, and competing noises can just drive me into a furious rage I can't control. My wife's phone rang. She was in the other room. The caller ID said, Tina. I answered it. Hello? An uncomfortable silence. A male voice.
Is Lily there?
My wife now stood in the doorway, hand outstretched for the phone, looking, what, sheepish? Or maybe pitying? I had long suspected my wife was having an affair. The pause, the false ID, and the fact that I recognized the voice of her work colleague, Mike, confirmed it for me. My head pulsed with anger, and the permanent high-pitched buzzing in my ears flared. I went into the garden to rage. I picked up the nearest object and slammed it into the ground. The shovel bit deep, and I hacked maniacally at the ground. It was dark by the time I went back into the house, and I felt calm. Exhausted, I fell into bed, slept well for the first time in months. That was how I decided to build a pond. I threw myself into digging, disposing of rocks and earth, researching pond liners, shapes, and planting schemes. I didn't care where my wife was or with whom. I was in the garden, working on my pond. It consumed me, and I felt at peace. When it was lined and bordered, I was ready to begin planting, and I started with my lily. Normally, the pond needs to be filled first, but the lack of water made it easy to plant the centerpiece. I filled the pond and called the kids down to admire my efforts. Work is a lot better now. When I told my boss about the affair and the fact that my wife had moved out, he really eased up on me. He had been through a messy divorce himself, so he understood. He was especially sympathetic that the children had gone with their mother. The buzzing in my ear seems to have subsided since my wife left. I sit by my pond each night. It's amazing to watch nature at work. It teems with life, and the newts especially seem to like it. Pond Life, written by author Adam Davies, narrated by Minkus Thormine.
It's that damn dream, again. The register at the checkout line says my card's declined. I read the cashier's name, Tammy. Well, Tammy, that's a mistake. Run it again, I know there's money in there. Tammy smirks as she runs the card again. She shakes her head at me before the machine even has a chance to determine the fate of my purchase. A large green bubble plumes from her mouth before popping and being sucked back in through her teeth.
Nope, sorry. It's declined. We could run it 100 times. It's not going to change anything.
Being an invisible bystander inside my own mind, I can't do anything but listen to myself yell at her. No! No fucking way! There was $3,005 in there just this morning! This is bullshit! Tammy shrugs both shoulders and calls out,
Next!
The gas light illuminates the dashboard a sickly orange. Fuel range low. I call my wife, Julia. The phone rings. No answer. She never answers her fucking phone. Always blaring those damn horror podcasts. I'll give her a horror podcast, all right, if she doesn't pick up her phone and explain why the bank is empty. Her cheery voice message plays in my annoyed ears.
Hey, this is Julia. Sorry I missed your call. Leave your name and number, and I'll get back to you. Honestly, though, text is probably best.
Okay, so you won't answer your goddamn phone, but you think a text will get your attention?
The driveway reveals a battered Geo Metro. At one time, I'm sure it was a handsome shade of blue. Not anymore, though. Julia runs out to greet me.
Hey, honey. Don't be mad, but I did a thing today.
Her hands gesture wildly toward the car in a frenzied showcase motion.
We got a new car. He was selling it for $5,000, but he gave it to me for $3,000. All it needs is some transmission work and a new fuel pump. Amazing, right?
She literally dances around the car, smiling at the sky. A demented flower child worshipping a pile of junk. Clouds of red flash through my vision. My temper is barely within the realm of control. I storm off inside the house and slam the door behind me. My bride is soon to follow. Jules, please, not now. I need a minute to calm down. Her face falls as she does the opposite of what I ask her to do.
What the fuck, Ben? Why are you being like this? What's your problem? Surprise, surprise, you hate a decision that I made, like everything else having to do with me.
Her voice trails as a trained whistle of rage consumes my hearing. I stand up, force my hands to her throat, and squeeze until I hear clicks of death that sound like turn signals, guiding her to the grave. Warning! Turning right for death! Please take heed. My eyes snap open. Julie isn't in bed. I look around the room until a white piece of paper catches my eye.
Ben, be back soon with a surprise. Love, Jules.
The nightmare I've been having all week still lingers so heavily in my mind. I still feel the crack of her neck resonate through my hands. A look of panic and surprise etched on her face, eyes fixed on me in a lifeless 1,000-yard stare. A shower brings me to much-needed clarity and relief. Of course there's money in the bank still. Julia is impulsive, but she wouldn't do anything that stupid. Especially not without talking to me first. She knows how desperately we've needed this money. We've been waiting on taxes all year to keep me out of jail and financial ruin. The $3,000 was just to keep them at bay. Barely a tip of the iceberg. If that money was gone, we'd be ruined forever. To some people, $3,000's not much. But to us, it's our saving grace. My pulse calms with relief to hear Julie pull in the driveway. The familiar at-home squeak of the front doorknob brings a smile to my face. I hear her voice before she's within sight.
Hey, honey, don't be mad, but I did a thing today. We got a new car. He was selling it for $5,000, but he gave it to me for $3,000. All it needs is some transmission work and a new fuel pump. Amazing, right?
My vision is overcome by flashes of red.
Geo Metro Nightmare was written by author N.M. Brown and was narrated by The White Rabbit and Jules 15.
I love Halloween. It's the one night of the year where I don't have to be my loser self. I can be a doctor, a rock star, a cowboy, or even a zoologist. No one dunks my head in the school toilets on Halloween. And it's the only day where no one calls me a weirdo or crybaby for liking race cars, dinosaurs, or Pokemon. I get to eat as much candy as I would like without my parents complaining, and I can even talk to other kids without feeling as shy as normal. I woke up this morning thinking that something's different about this Halloween. Maybe it was the way the leaves are blowing, or how it felt way colder than usual, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. I didn't have time this year to plan for a costume, since I'd been volunteering at the local animal shelter after school, so I went to see what I could find in the attic. My mom had a trunk of stuff that she called her hippie day clothes, and as I rifled through the bell-bottom jeans and woven headbands, I came across what looked like an old Hawaiian-style grass skirt with strange symbols on the leather waistband. It almost looked real, though, and it seemed to be made from woven leaves rather than neon green plastic strips. Mom always had warned me not to go through stuff, but she never said why. So I figured she just didn't want me in the attic, where some of the floorboards weren't the most stable. Soon, with a bit of skeleton face paint and a wizard staff from a medieval LARP I attended 2 years ago, I had a pretty decent witch doctor outfit. I wore a long-sleeved black shirt to keep myself warm, and I had even found an old Native American bear claw necklace of my dad's to complement my costume. I was excited, and I grabbed a pillowcase for my candy and headed out the door. As soon as my foot landed on my porch step, something splattered across my face. I wiped the raw egg off of my cheek, cringing as the yolk slid down my lips. On my lawn was Jax, a kid in my grade, and his two younger brothers. The three of them were my main bullies, and I dreaded seeing them.
Look at the little crybaby. He's wearing girl clothes.
Without thinking, I pointed my staff at them. I didn't know what I would do, maybe throw it at them, but what happened terrified me. A burst of blue light shot from it, and sitting where Jax once stood was a frog. His brothers began screaming, and my parents rushed outside to see what was going on. What had I done?
The Witch Doctor was written by Elena Robertson-Webb and was narrated by Quinn Grace.
I don't know how long I've been here. Judging by the stomach pains and the stench of human waste, my guess would be a day? Maybe two? The last thing I remember was being on the boardwalk with my girlfriends, having one too many drinks and spilling all the tea. I fell down a few times from the liquid courage, you know, typical. "Brienne, you're so graceful," my friends mocked. I guess I get two left feet when inebriated. Who doesn't? I met up with them after a long day of babysitting my sister's twins. Those little shits get under my skin sometimes. Great birth control, though, I guess. I must have blacked out, because the next thing I remembered was being in this box. When I woke up, I panicked. My breath turned into short spurts of anxiety as I screamed for help. No one heard. My throat felt like I had swallowed sand. Water. I need water. It's so dark down here. So dark. I felt around the limited space I was afforded when my hand hit a bottle. Praise be. I struggled to get it open as my hands trembled around the cap. I immediately poured the substance into my mouth, too thirsty to care if it was poisoned. It burned my esophagus as it went down. Vodka? Why? I accepted the warm comfort of the spirit. My empty stomach, however, heaved in response. Acid scorched my tongue like a yellow flame. I pounded on my wooden enclosure. Somebody help me! I cried. Tears fell down my cheeks like salty drops of betrayal. I felt the floor vibrate as a dim light appeared near my feet. My phone! I scrambled my legs as adrenaline coursed through my veins. Calm down, Brienne. You have to calm down, I chanted in my head. The air was thick and muggy. Sweat mixed with my tears as I tried to reach for the phone. Just a few more inches. After minutes of struggle, I felt the cold metal on the tips of my fingers. I got it. I pulled it to my face, only to realize it wasn't mine. It appeared to be some sort of burner phone. I flipped it open and immediately tried to dial 911. It was no use. I couldn't make any calls out. I clicked over to the message icon and my blood ran cold.
Hello, Brienne. Do you like games?
What the fuck? My fingers grasped onto the device until I thought they might bleed. Cursing under my breath, I punched in my reply. Who the fuck is this? I shook with anger. My phone lit up almost immediately.
Wrong answer.
I held my breath as I felt my enclosure begin to shake. Before I had the chance to comprehend what was happening, I was weightless. The box began to drop quickly along with my stomach. I heard a sharp snap like a whip, and then it was over. My heart was racing in my chest. I wasn't below ground. I was above it. Way above it. I gasped for air and begged my body to settle while I brought the phone back up to my face.
Now that I have your attention, let's play, shall we? Do you know why you are here?
My heart sank into my chest. I had no fucking idea why someone would want this to happen to me. I began to sob at the thought of falling again. My fingers traced the letters I would reply. I closed my eyes and hit send. No, please. I'm so scared. I begged. My phone shook in my hand. I closed my eyes and inhaled sharply through my teeth, waiting for the drop. The box remained still. I screamed into the darkness as my phone lit up again.
I'm sure Bella was just as scared as you are right now.
The words cut into me like a dull knife. Bella. More tears began to fall. Bella was a little girl that I used to babysit. She passed away 2 years ago, but it wasn't my fault. There was nothing I could have done. God, it wasn't my fault! I yelled as I pounded my fist into the wood above my head.
Wrong answer.
The box dropped again, further this time. I pissed myself on the descent. My whole body began to tremble in shock. What do you want from me? I yelled. I cried out into the void, begged for someone to hear, for someone to save me from this hell. When I was answered with silence, I took a deep breath. I brought the phone back up to my face and exhaled. I had been drinking. I'm so sorry. I lost control of the vehicle and we went into the river. I tried. I tried to save her. I promise. I swear I tried. I gripped the phone in my sweaty palm and waited.
Wrong answer.
A timer started flashing when I started typing this, and I don't know what it means. The box is swaying back and forth, and I've drank the rest of the vodka. It wasn't much, but enough to calm my nerves. The timer is at 5 minutes now, and if this is the end, I need to confess. I didn't try to save Bella. I could have, but I was too scared and decided to save myself instead. I don't know if anyone will read this, but I needed to get it out. I needed to confess. I have 1 minute left. I'm so sorry. I'm just so sorry.
My name is Grace, and I am a detective for the beautiful city of Seattle. Yesterday, I received an anonymous phone call giving me the coordinates to a murder scene, but my 9 years on the job did not prepare me for what I would find. Shards of broken pieces of wood were sprawled across the pavement, along with bits of flesh and viscera. Given the appearance and stench of the melted goo, the heat had not been kind the last few days. My hand flew up to my mouth as I made my way over to the pancake before me. A reflection from a piece of metal caught the sun just right, catching my attention. I looked down and noticed a hand tightly wrapped around a phone. I put on some gloves and pried the bloated appendages from the device before opening it up. The first thing I read is what I have typed above. For any of this to make sense, you needed to know. The next thing I read caused goosebumps to spread over my entire body.
Hello, Detective Grace. On this device, you will find the full confession of Brianne Marie for the murder of Bella Mitchell. Brianne is the first of many. Everyone has secrets, Detective, and they need to confess. The hangman is coming, and he intends to collect. Everyone has secrets. What's yours? Was written by author Melody Grace and was narrated by Sinister Sweetheart, Jack Sanders, and Newsy's Modern Dreadfuls.
I remember running to my mom. I was 7. And in the night, a brownish wart appeared on the palm of my right hand. I remember her putting some cream on it, but it didn't go away. We all ever have our own frame of reference for the things that happen to us, and having a wart is hardly the most unusual of occurrences. The second wart appeared at age 9, and by 11 I had 3, forming a little triangle. As I entered my teenage years, changes took place all over my body, and a long red welt appeared on my palm, making it look like a little face with 2 eyes, a nose, and a mouth. I began to sprout hair under my arms and between my legs. Coarse little bristles appeared all over the original warts, creating the impressions of eyebrows. I started to feel self-conscious about it. I would hide my freak hand as much as possible. It was always buried in a glove or deep in pockets. I found other uses for my right hand at that age. It was during one of these sessions of self-pleasuring that I first felt the mouth welt move. It seemed to part slightly, as if it was a pair of lips, and it kissed me while I worked away. My skin prickled hot. It was disgusting, but the pleasurable end to my work came quickly. I laid my hand out on the table, palm up, a kitchen knife in my left hand. I didn't know what I'd planned, but I didn't want to be the freak anymore. I pressed the tip of my knife against the nose wart, and to my horror, its eyes flicked open. I dropped the knife, shocked, and the mouth opened, revealed tiny yellowish teeth.
Not hurt,
it said in a foul, sneering voice.
Pleasure.
I'm sickened to say I gave it its wish. That became its nightly call. it would whisper to me,
"Pleasure,"
and I would oblige. I became an outcast at school, too ashamed of my freak hand to keep friends or have a girlfriend. At night, it began to urge me.
"Not you, girl."
Each morning as I left for school or college, it would whine.
"Not gloves. Not duck."
It's began to bite me in my sleep. Its desire to take a new form of pleasure growing stronger and more insistent every day. She's lying naked on the bed. She tries her best, but can't stifle her scream as I take off my gloves and she sees the leering face. She makes to move, but looks over at the large pile of cash on the motel room table. Neither her sobs nor my own can drown out the lapping sounds as my facepalm takes its new pleasure. Then I hear it say,
"Blood,"
and I feel its teeth sink into her.
Facepalm was written by author Adam Davies and narrated by Jack Sanders.
Hurry up, Daddy. Natalie will be here any minute.
I looked down to see my daughter, Bree, excitedly dancing in front of me. It was Sunday, which meant it was officially tea party day, and Bee was not about to let me forget it. I tried to tell her last week that she could invite any number of her friends over, but she only wanted Natalie, her imaginary friend. I watched as she bounded towards her room, pigtails flying behind her as fake china clinked in her hands. I smiled as I closely followed with a teapot full of juice. Once I reached her room, I noticed exactly three chairs set up, one for me, one for her, and one for Natalie. I took my place in the largest chair while Bree very carefully began to pour the tea into our respective cups. Natalie's was purple, of course, her favorite color.
"Dad, you should say hi to Natalie. It's rude to ignore her,"
Bree retorted as she poured my tea last. "Oh, sorry, honey. Hi, Natalie. Very happy to have you," I smiled at the empty chair. Bree giggled in return. I'm sure most kids her age also have imaginary friends, but for some reason, Natalie concerned me. Bree had made up this very elaborate background story for her, and to put it lightly, it was disturbing. Apparently, Natalie had grown up in a foster home her whole life, never having been able to stay longer than a few months at a time.
"She has a lazy eye, and no one wanted her because she's scary looking. But now she lives under our neighbor's basement,"
my little girl explained to me one night. It broke my heart to hear her make up such a tale. Maybe she wasn't taking our move as well as I had hoped. I looked across the table at my sweet daughter talking enthusiastically to her special friend. I watched as she poured Natalie another glass of juice, mentally making note that that was in fact Bree's third glass, and she would be needing to use the bathroom soon. Moments later, upon Bree's request, I quietly excused myself to grab the crackers and cheese from the kitchen. I got about halfway down the hall when I heard the bathroom door shut. Called it. I returned shortly with a plate of crackers and cheese to find my daughter sitting sweetly in her chair. "Did you wash your hands, sweetheart?" I asked nonchalantly, trying to not embarrass her.
"Oh, I didn't use the bathroom, Daddy. Nat did. And yes, she washed her hands."
Bree batted her big brown eyes at me. I sighed. At least she washed her hands, I guess. Once we were finished with our tea and crackers, Bree announced that Natalie had to go home now. I went through the whole charade of guessing where her coat was, while my little girl laughed at all my attempts before simply telling me where she had set it. Holding the air in her hand, I watched her walk Natalie to our front door and hug her goodbye. Once she was satisfied that her friend had left, Bree turned onto her heels and ran towards the playroom, announcing she was going to color her a picture for next time. I shook my head. Oh, to have that sort of imagination again. I turned to make my way to the kitchen when I heard our doorbell ring. As I opened the door, I found my front porch empty. Just before I could close it, I heard Bree yell at me from the other room.
"Natalie says she forgot her bracelet in my room. Can you grab it for her, Daddy?"
I looked at the empty space on my porch and decided to amuse my daughter. Wait right here, Natalie," I yelled loud enough for Bree to hear. I walked back into her room and looked around the table. It was void of any bracelet. I chuckled to myself as I called out, "Ah, here it is!" Then something caught my eye. I glanced down at the purple teacup and noticed a shiny silver bracelet inside. My hands began to shake as I picked it up. As I slowly turned it over, I saw the name. Natalie. Delicately written on the inside.
The Tea Party was written by author Melody Grace and was narrated by Minkus Thormine and Erica Letitia.
It's been 8 months since the incident, and I'm still hearing sirens in my sleep. It was a Thursday evening. I came home from work to an empty house. My wife Lena's clothes and phone weren't missing. Her cell phone sat abandoned on our counter, vibrating with calls and notifications. The only thing signifying that she hadn't been abducted was her missing car. I hadn't even completed all three numbers of 911 when police officers came to my door, and our neighbor Janice stood behind them, eyes rimmed red with tears. She had asked Lena to pick her son Thomas up from school due to a work emergency, meaning he was also missing. They questioned Janice and I repeatedly over the following weeks to no avail. We knew less than they did. No one wanted our loved ones home more than we did. Janice and I got the answers we asked for about 2 months later, but they weren't the ones we wanted. Lena's car was found burned up, crushed like a tin can. Someone saw a set of tire tracks heading off the mountainside and called it in once they saw the wreckage at the bottom. This New Year's Eve, I finally got the courage to try to remove the last of Lena's clothes from the house. The closet had been cleared, leaving only the items she kept in the linen trunk. I painstakingly packed up her favorite skirts, dresses, and shoes. My heart felt emptier with every new item I removed from it. My heart broke to find a heart-shaped box at the bottom, one I'd never seen before. A tag was taped atop it, and my name scrawled across it in red ink. There was no lock, no key to be found. Only a simple metal clasp kept me from the last gift my wife would ever give me. My fingers fumbled to open it in frenzied anticipation. The endless possibilities of her love called to me from inside. Once it opened, I felt my soul freeze and then shatter. Tears ran down my face as I punched our closet walls until my knuckles bled. Laid inside was a simple scrap of bloody paper. A set of latitude and longitude coordinates which I found led to the same mountainside her car was found at the bottom at. It was written in my wife's handwriting along with a message. Dear Tobin, I know about you and Janice. It always killed me that Thomas had your eyes.
Hidden Valentine was written by author N.M. Brown and was narrated by Ken Sampso.
Pathetic, blind fools. You don't see them. They're watching you from the shadows. They're lusting after you, your warmth, your vitality, your blood, your souls. You don't see them. But you choose not to see me. All you see is a vagrant, homeless bum. Dirty, unkempt hair and wild eyes. Not make eye contact with a filthy creature. You will want our food or money or worse. You will try to talk to us. God forbid any of you stop to talk. Stop to listen. I see them. I see them like their lips and cruel teeth as they plot against you with dark and terrible intention. I tried to warn you, but you don't listen as well as don't see. I whisper about them as you pass. Watch out, I hiss. And you jump and speed up, desperate to be away from me. It's not me you need to fear. I have tried shouting to them. I stripped naked and screeched, "The devil's in the shadows! They are coming for you! They are coming for us all! They will drink your blood and devour your souls! They will take your little girl!" I pointed to the passing family. It did no good. They locked me away. It hurt me. Today I will make you see. I'm standing in the square, jacket and medal in my hand. You pass all around me. Invisible force field of my squalor and my madness keeping you at bay. I shot my warning one last time. The devils and the shadows are here for you. Flee while you can. Blood will draw them. You're here for the blood. My long life on the cruel streets have taught me pain. Even so, I could never have imagined the searing agony of the tearing of my flesh. My shots are wet, red gurgle now. All around me you scream. Most of you backing away from the scene. One brave soul rushes forward to hell. Her hand over my gaping, ruined throat. She tries to soothe me.
"It's okay,"
she tells me.
"Somebody call an ambulance!"
She pleads. I grab her wrist. "Shadows," I whisper to her. "Can you see the shadow?" She looks up confused. Her eyes widen with terror. She sees them. And I die with a heavy heart. I had always hoped that they were just in my mind.
"You Don't See Them" was written by author Adam Davies and was narrated by Sir Soothing Voice, featuring Sinister Sweetheart.
I gotta tell you, I've been a carny for as long as I can remember, and I've never seen something as fucked up as this. My mouth's been running to anyone who'll listen, but no one believes me. Maybe you can help. Every weekend, hundreds of people flood the amusement park that I work at, yet no one notices the statue garden. By that, I'm not saying that they ignore it, I'm saying that they never notice the changes. We pack and unpack at all kinds of cities across the US. Every time that we leave town, a new kid goes missing. The boss doesn't think anyone will catch on. He seems to be right so far. But this time, I have proof. Our carnival's location receives Amber Alert hours after we've left. There are no traces of us to be found. Not that anyone suspects us. Who would believe such a thing? Besides me, I mean. This young boy is different from the others. He was born without his left thumb. His left ear was misshapen due to his positioning in the womb. All I had to do was show them the new statue. Then people would have to believe. I usher the officer to the statue garden area and show him our newest addition. "Look there," I point frantically. "The statue! He's missing an ear and a thumb! I'm telling you, something has turned these children into stone! We have to free them!" Officer sighs in annoyance, clearly not taking me seriously. Just like all the others, I can't take it anymore. Those children are suffocating in there. They're even still alive. My shoulder rams the statue with as much force as I can manage. After my second attempt, it topples to the ground. The clack of stone breaking against the concrete ground is almost deafening. The officer next to me turns a deathly white. His jaw drops at the sight before us. I try my best not to scream, unsuccessfully. Where the dust of broken stone should be, there's blood. Instead of broken bits of rubble, there's bone. The officer finally believes me. Now he thinks I'm the one responsible for it.
The Shrinking Statues was written by author N.M. Brown and was narrated by Winterbeat.
I looked out into the darkness. Suddenly it smelled back, flashing crooked teeth.
Worms are everywhere, all around us. If you went outside now and looked in your garden, you would find dozens, hundreds even. Scientists estimate that for every 26 kilograms of biomass of mammals above ground, there is a corresponding 330 kilograms of worm biomass below ground. They outweigh all mammalian life by around 12 to 1. Although they are simple creatures, you can teach a worm to find its way out of a maze by shining lights down the correct passages. If you cut a worm in half, each half grows into a new worm. If you take a worm that has been taught its way out of the maze and cut it in half, astonishingly, each half will also know its way out of the maze. Even more incredible, if you mince up a worm that knows its way out of a maze and feed it to a different worm, that new worm will now also know its way out of the maze. A maze it has never seen or been near. Worms are amazing creatures. They operate a kind of cellular memory that has never been observed in any other creatures. Swiss scientists, wanting to know more about the astonishing properties of worms, laced the food of hundreds of earthworms with radioactive isotopes to allow them to trace these amazing creatures' underground paths and habits. They were shocked to discover that over time, every worm made its way to the same location, sometimes traveling hundreds of miles underground. Once they reached this point, all the worms seemed to begin to travel slowly in the same direction. This is how the Worm King was discovered. He tunnels underneath us, a pale giant, corpulent and stinking of the grave. He calls all his subjects to pay homage to him. They come, and with them they bring knowledge, for the monstrous Worm King devours them all, his knowledge and his power always growing. Worms are simple creatures with simple minds, but consider grave worms, who devour first our eyes and then our brains as we lie rotting in the earth. Is it really nourishment they seek? No, they are servants of the Worm King, sent to find out what we know. They use their unique cellular memory to take our thoughts and our memories back to their cruel master, to show the Worm King what the world above ground looks like. Over half the world's population have parasitic worms living inside their bodies already. Threadworms, pinworms, roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms are just some of the Worm King's troops already positioned against us. They squirm inside you, unseen and unknown. He lies beneath us, this Worm King, seeing what we see, knowing what we know. He grows jealous of the brightness and warmth of our world above ground. He plots, and he schemes, and he waits. He knows his time is soon at hand. He knows his assassins are in place. And he likes his 12-1 odds.
The Worm King was written by author Adam Davies and was narrated by Evan Locke. I miss my husband. It's our 15th Valentine's Day as a couple and he has to work. They say that one of the keys to a great marriage is compromise, so I'm taking it upon myself to improvise. We've sent messages back and forth all day, along with some very private pictures. He gets off work in 1 hour. That gives me just enough time to set up for his homecoming. I went out and bought 2 gorgeous ribeyes at the market with some asparagus and hollandaise, his favorite. There's a bottle of wine chilling in the fridge, and my YouTube account is all set up with a romantic sexy time playlist. My mind reels with adoration when I think of how long we've been together. On the table are freshly chilled chocolate-covered strawberries, 2 wine glasses, a clean ashtray, joint, and lighter. The steaks are resting and warmed along with the veggies. The dining room is set for the perfect evening. On to the bedroom. I've placed flameless candles around the room, Hubby hates a hot room. And the bed is made with fresh silken sheets. Now to get myself ready, I place my clothes on the bed. He likes me in pinks best. I scent them with his favorite perfume. My blood warms at the thought of his touch. On the counter is a lovingly written note that reads, "Your Valentine is waiting in the bath. Help yourself to the table, then come on in. I love you." My body is relieved of the weight of my clothes as I start to run the bath. The scented body wash is poured in. I watch the still water start to pop and bubble with excitement. Slowly, I lower myself into the tub, letting the warmth of the water envelop me like a blanket. I start playing music on my phone as I lay my head back and close my eyes. The front doorknob squeaks as it opens. Then I hear it close. Hubby's home! From the living room, I hear the sound of shoes shuffling to the dining room table. I wriggle my frame down further into the water, smiling wickedly. The flick of a lighter sounds, and soon I can smell the sweet scent of burned rope. A pop resounds as a wine cork dislodges from its bottle. I wonder if he's gotten my note yet. Then I hear a crashing sound, like something's knocked over. I can hear the footsteps walking closer to the bathroom. My joy is like a child's on Christmas. "Baby, are you all right out there? I cleaned all day to make everything nice. Are you going to share that?" "I'm waiting." There's no response. He's almost at the door now. Suddenly, then, the music is interrupted by a text message alert. It's from my husband.
"Hey, honey. I'm sorry. I'm stuck at the office for a little bit longer. Love you. Can't wait to see you."
A Perfect Evening was written by author N.M. Brown and narrated by Sinister Sweetheart and Minkus Thormine.
My fetid friend, I wanted to thank you for listening. And I hope to see you again very soon in my fields.
This audio production is copyrighted by Scarecrow Tales. No copying or reproduction is permitted without the prior written permission of Scarecrow Tales. The copyrights of each story are held by the respective authors.